ancillary activities, we make our construction expertise available as a service to other state agencies. The Veterans Building, the Fair are two of our current major clients, so to speak, in this business. But we've also done, during this past biennium, we have given assistance to a number of other state agencies at their request, and we expect to continue to do that. And we hope that as we become more effective in what we're doing, more people will come to us for assistance. We have a lands management program. The legislation gives the department the responsibility for managing surplus public lands. These are surplus institution or former Board of Control lands. Most of this is farmland, and our primary thrust for managing that land is to lease it to farmers. We have 1,192 acres currently leased out to farmers. It does not produce a significant income, but it keeps the land in good shape in trust for future development by the state when that might be needed. We maintain a statewide land inventory. This is all of the lands held by the state, except highway right-of-ways and repossessed homes from the Veterans Administration. And we conducted a major update of that during this past biennium, actually during this past year. With that update, we hope to be able to continue to keep it with the normal staff without any major thrust. Finally, we...
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Before we do it all, does that include the forest lands and also state lands, as far as the state lands board, the division of state lands, do you do that too?
Yes, sir. We have an inventory of all lands owned by any agency of the state of Oregon, except for those few items which I didn't mention. For your interest, there are 2,824,000 acres of land in state ownership with a current estimated value of $4
billion.
$4
billion?
Yes.
You keep an inventory, is that all?
That's...
You say we own this section over here, but you don't manage or advise or...
That's correct.
What is that? I know that the Board of Forestry, State Board of Forestry, must have the same inventory. I don't know whether they get it off of your records or you get yours off of their records, but if that costs very much, that's simply duplication. State Land Board, I've had both of their budgets in forestry, and they all know exactly how many acres. I don't know if it's necessary for you to know.
It's actually, our data comes from them, and this is not really a major cost item. In terms of just assimilating all of those inventories from the state agencies. We do it because there's a statutory requirement. I'm not sure that we're very excited about doing it. I suppose there is some value in having somebody somewhere that has a central inventory, but as far as we're concerned, it's sort of a pain to do it. I think we should amplify, though, that there are many lands that we are actually managing, much smaller in size. I think there's about 1,000 acres that Fred is actually managing right now. And the way that works is that when an agency begins to think that land is surplus, then we start managing it. Okay. And a lot of the lands that we're managing are old Board of Control lands out here that transferred to us when the Board of Control was abolished. But I think you ought to know that the land board lands, the forestry land, those kinds of wild land or whatever you want to tag them, we really don't get involved in any kind of management activity, even if it's surplus. I think that that we just don't have much role in that, and I'm not sure that we need to have any role in that.
Yeah, I don't either.
Each one of those lands that you're talking about have a dedicated
use of the revenue too, like forestry land goes to forestry. Those lands that are the lands in eastern Oregon, when we lease out, I don't know how many thousand sections we have, but they're all dedicated to the,
right,
the common school fund, and no one can touch the money. And it's,
really, the only place that we have any management responsibility is in lands that were acquired with general fund, if you want to get right to the heart of the issue. If the general fund has any investment in it, then we get involved in it.
And I have no quarrel with that. I'm just wondering, and I just, and I'd like to know the duplication and what that costs, what costs are involved in that, because I can't, you know, I can't see any, I just can't see any reason for you to do that. And you said you're not too excited about it. I'm not either.
We take their list, we take all lists, we put them on one sheet of paper, and we probably have $1,000 investment per biennium in that activity. You know, we don't do a thing with those lists. And if you want to abolish the function, it'd be okay with us. You know, we aren't.
But I think that's the only, your department's the only one that keeps all the inventories together.
That's right.
You could pick one out there, then you might have to go to the highway department or the forestry department to find out separately, but as a whole, then he's got it. It's the only, only reason I can see to keep it.
Is that? Over 1,000.
Yeah.
Well, and he also has under him a little board that to deal with surplus lands to sell, don't you? I mean, a public board.
Public Lands Advisory Board.
Yeah, that says we don't need these little quarter sections where a highway curved was straightened out or things like that. But you, you finally make the disposal sales.
And that's not a budgeted activity. We just do it.
You do it, but I mean, when they decide that we don't need that kind of land.
There was a bill went through the House the other day that gives the Department of Transportation the opportunity to sell any parcel of land like that that's under $5,000 or something.
Without a bid.
They can now do that up to $1,000, and they want to raise it to five, and that's fine with us.
Yeah. It's gone through both houses. But that's to let them get rid of it. You know, you think if you were to take a map of all of these thousands of little sections that we got, one lot that we have really no business owning, but once it gets on the highway roll or something, it never gets off. And probably because we don't have anybody that has them all together and saying, what are we doing with this property?
We have a lot of land that state owns that I think is questionable, frankly.
To keep owning.
Yeah, the 300 acres out here that we've been working on now for 2 years, hopefully we're going to get rid of that 300 acres. As soon as the city and general services can agree on terms, we're going to sell that 300 acres.
To the city?
Well, it'll be for industrial development. And
Crossville Fairview?
Mm-hmm, right. It'll be for industrial development, and we're working with the city on actually how to do that.
I'd just like to ask one more question here and then let you go on that. But I'm not really embarrassed about slowing you down a little bit. But we're in a little shortfall of revenues. We got to, couldn't you kind of bail us out? sell some of this expensive land? How many dollars are we talking about out here, approximately, as far as the 300 acres are concerned?
It's hard to peg. I would imagine it's less than 10 million. It's probably around 5 or 6 million that we're talking about.
You got any other pieces of property that are worth a pile of bucks that you know that you really would like to get rid of too?
I think that my own opinion is that we need to be cautious in this area, because we're taking lands that were acquired by people 50 years ago with a lot of foresight for state public use. And we're really talking about getting rid of an asset for our children. And so before we get rid of that asset, I think we want to be very careful. If we get the $5 million out of the sale of the 300 acres, it's going to be gone just like that. I think we have to realize that the money's going to be spent immediately. And so I guess my recommendation to you is that we ought not to sell land unless we really know that our children are not going to need it. Now, in the case of the 300 acres, that thing has been studied since 72. I think two different times by the Public Lands Advisory Board that Senator Ripper mentioned, and everybody agrees it's bottom land, it's in a floodplain, it's just not, there's just no use for it, and so we ought to get rid of it. But I think we ought to be cautious and go through that kind of real intensive study before we really sell something off. But once we make that decision, I think we ought to sell it. And I do think there are two other parcels of land that we're going to be asking the Public Lands Advisory Board to look at in the next 3 or 4 months for possible sale, but they're much smaller in size. I think one's only 30 or 40 acres.
Okay.
You could take that land and put it in the mall building.
There you
and
go.
Then you would have, well, but in relation to what you're saying, then you are taking care of posterity in a sense, and that you took one investment here for another public investment to come back for.
That's a good point.
Let's see, Mr. Chairman, there's one last program activity that the division is involved in. There are a number of sewer and water systems throughout the Salem area serving the institutions in the area. Traditionally, the Department of General Services has paid the city and then billed the local institutions. We are, in other words, simply processing money. This biennium arrived at agreement with the city and with the institutions such that the billings will be direct. We're trying to divest ourselves of major segments of these systems, put them into a City of Salem ownership so that they can have the maintenance responsibilities for them rather than the state. That's kind of the picture of our program responsibilities. This reduced level budget, as I said when I started, does not anticipate any kind of an expansion of the program, simply improvements and refinements to the program. Our administrative budget or our operating budget only increases by 7.6%, which is less than the inflation period between the two bienniums. And we're not asking for any staff increase at this time, nor are there any decision packages in the governor's budget.
Mr. Chairman, the next thing the Fed would go to would be capital improvement, but bearing in mind that you wanted to stop at 9:45, should we postpone capital improvement till the next meeting?
I see. How much more time have we got scheduled for them?
We've got them scheduled through Wednesday of next week.
Then we would have plenty of time with that. What I would like to do, Darrell, is, number one, I would like to get the answers that Representative Rewa asked about on the rent question. Mm-hmm. So you would have that. Now you'll have to have that, prepare that, won't you?
No, we actually have material in our digest here, so I think we can answer the question.
Why don't we? Okay.
Well, you go ahead with it, Mr. Chairman.
We'll go ahead, and you answer. See if you can clear that up, so we know where we're on that. And then I'll save about 5 minutes for some comments if you want to make. Well, how would that be? Can you do that about 10 minutes for us?
Yeah. Let's turn first to page 5E. I think that's where the uniform rent chart is that we've given you. Now, 5E lists the uniform rent, and you'll see the 60 cents for an ex-biennium and how it is broken down. All of our operating costs, everything that relates to running these buildings, are stuck in here. Down toward the bottom, you'll see depreciation reserve, and Representative Riebel mentioned the cost of the building. The way we have historically operated our property program is that the general fund built the building, and then we depreciated the building back to the occupants so that we picked up all the federal funds and dedicated funds we possibly could. What this means is the general fund does not finance on a long-term basis the burden. We get the money back from the agencies, and the general fund is simply one of the funding sources. And then we have our depreciation reserve, which is available for building other buildings. We actually have a couple $1 million of depreciation reserve revenues anticipated next biennium that are available for capital construction next biennium. So these costs are the same as the private sector. What is not listed here are taxes, and profit and interest or debt servicing. Okay. Now, we admit, I would not make the case that we're more efficient than the private sector. I couldn't make that case that we're more efficient than the private sector. What I will make the case on is that the same principle applies as that of owning your house. It is more effective for you to buy a house, even if you have to pay interest, so that you end up with an equity than it is to rent. And that's why most people decide to buy a house rather than to rent a house. In addition, because we are a government and we don't have to pay taxes, and because in the past with general fund financing we've not had to pay debt servicing, it is even more cheaper than the principle of buying your own house.
Let me interrupt you here. Let me ask you a question. How can you, what I keep hearing is that people say we're really getting ripped off by the private sector, and I'm not talking about you, but I'm talking about various people in the legislature. They say, look at what the private sector is doing to us. We're only paying 60 cents for rental of this space, but the private sector is charging us 70, 80, 90 cents. I think it's totally unrealistic. Then there's no way in God's green earth that you could rent that space over there for 60 cents. Now, I take, when you do this, of balancing them out one to the other, you can do that. But you can't rent that space for 60 cents. Now, if you took this and plugged these same factors in, and you used them as a cost factor for what it cost you to construct that building, it can't come out to 60 cents.
You're right. The only thing that I can think of that would change on this chart is the depreciation reserve. The depreciation would go up. If we built one of these charts just for that building, the depreciation reserve would go up. Because we've averaged depreciation reserve out among all buildings. And we do that for some good administrative reasons, but Representative Riebel is right that the real cost of that building is higher than 60 cents. Okay. It is still cheaper, though, than the private sector lease.
Oh, yeah. Well, I understand.
But it is not 60 cents for that building. You're right. And it won't be 60 cents for Mall 2. But we still will make the case that it is less expensive because we don't pay profit to the landowner. He's not going to rent to us unless he makes profit. If we use general fund money, we're not going to pay debt servicing, and that's not going to be valid for Mall 2 because we are going to end up paying debt servicing. But we don't pay debt servicing on Mall 1, and we don't pay property taxes. And so that's how it can be more economical. I would not make the case that we're being ripped off. I think that you have to bear in mind that you pay for what you get. And if you get into the marketplace, you're going to pay the market price. But if you look at any big company, they will either own their own buildings or they may be financing or leasing their buildings for tax purposes. But they lease because of the tax advantages and the cash flow advantages of leasing.
Well, I disagree with you a little bit there. If you look at Safeway Company and you find out what Safeway does, they take long-term leases, but they also know that there's obsolescence built in buildings.
Right.
Now, you're going to have obsolescence on your buildings just like everybody else does because, you know, I watch them knocking out doors and putting in partitions and everything in all these buildings, and yet we really don't sometimes talk about the real cost. The labor and industry building and some of these, every time I go by there, every other year, there's somebody's got a great big dump out in the middle of it, and they're tearing out some walls and putting in some more. And the, you know, they have to redo that space. I don't know where that comes, but I guess my feeling is that sometimes we, and I'm learning a lot from these other gentlemen that have been around here a heck of a lot longer than I have. But you find things in these various budgets that. You know, maybe they belong someplace else and try to ferret out what some other agency is doing to, or do they have to come to you every time they spend a nickel on tearing a wall out or something? Can they do that without your...
No, they have to have our approval. We do a lot of the remodeling ourselves, but agencies do some remodeling on their own as well. But I would hope that to convince you that our buildings really don't become obsolete. Where Safeway or other firms of the private sector that are in marketing and merchandising, they do have a lot of obsolescence because of the changing product that they're selling. In our case, an office building is an office building. I think that the Equitable Center or other office buildings have the same principle that we're talking about in our own buildings. They don't change that much. The occupant may change, but the function does not change. Those buildings have been there for, you know, I guess most of them, or some of them, for 50 years, and they haven't changed, and they're good for another 100 years, probably because of the, well, the construction. Mall 1 and Mall 2 are much better, technologically speaking, buildings because of the new direction of our building program, which is open office space buildings. We don't have all these walls. And there are very few private offices in Mall 1 and 2, and that's the direction our building program ought to go, because then we can make radical changes in the usage of that building without having to tear all these walls out.
Okay, now, let me just ask you.
Go ahead. No, this is
along that same line, why, you know, you and I talked about this before, but it just seems totally illogical to me that we got 42 different kinds of panel systems wandering around the state of Oregon. Now, you got one series upstairs that were made by fiberglass or somebody like that, and you go and try and get another panel, and they say, well, I'm sorry, but those are out of production now. And you go over to another building, and you had some guy out here construct some at one time that built some, and then you go to another manufacturer, another manufacturer, another manufacturer. It would just seem logical to me that we ought to get, and you and I have talked about this again, standardized for a period of time, whether we're going to buy them from Steelcase or whomever it is, and over a period of time buy them on a more standardized basis for 2 or 3 years so that they can be interchangeable. And if somebody over in the building X over here wants to put in two more secretarial stations, that we'll have some kind of a warehousing process where we can take them from one place and take them to another. But you know, I just really rankles me that we've got this thing going on here. I see the office building I'm in located in Portland now has exactly the same thing that you do, but they also can switch people around and they have an inventory of panels. And it seems to me like in the guise of trying to save money on low bid, we really fouled ourselves up by having a multitude of manufacturers out there.
No. Right. Yeah.
Your office could do this by setting the specs, couldn't it?
Well, he's under restriction, though. He and I have talked about this, and we're going to sit down with Ike Condell and some people.
Can he even put it in specs over this, well, so that everything does say that these have to be interchangeable and they will connect?
Well, we can require them to be related or interrelated, but the engineering is totally different on these. They look totally different. These panels come from all different directions from an engineering standpoint, and we cannot specify under current rules, we cannot specify a particular design, or we are violating the open competitive process. I think Representative Rebo is really right on the point in terms of the problem, and he mentioned typewriters and some others the other day, and I think he's right, and we share his concern.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Representative Rebo, we have a project in process to design a petition to be manufactured by Prism Industries. We have retained a consultant to design a custom package suited to state's needs, which would hopefully be manufactured by Prism Industries, and therefore we could have a consistent product for an extended period of time without having to be vulnerable to the changing winds of the industry.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to add one thing to that, though. I have not yet made a decision that they're going to be constructed at Prism Industries. We are designing a partition. The intention to be to find a manufacturer. Now, that we may manufacture them through Prism Industries, we may manufacture them on the private market. We are in the process, we have technical staff on the payroll looking at the possibility of actually designing a partition. But we're still going to run into the same problem that Representative Rebo was talking about from the standpoint of the manufacturing. Unless we find one manufacturer for us, we're going to have the same problem he points out. So I think his principle is still valid.
Okay.
Thank you.
This has been a good... This is all good information. Let's take my time on. I think what I'll do now is this pretty well covered. You folks, we got it pretty well, about as far up as we can make it so far. Yeah. But anyway, why don't Steve? why don't you give us some comments? I didn't mean that. That is a sound. But and you were talking about you had some comments about the other. But why don't you just take a few minutes on that, so we have something to go through our mind or something for them to come back with.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, if I can take you back a few days to the printing division and their budget, I've made some initial recommendations here. And again, when we have the agency up for work session, I can map these all out for you, and then the committee can take a look at them on the whole. Excuse me. Your staff's the opinion that while the printing work required of the state printing plant remains at a lower than normal level, there is reason to believe that should the funds become available in the future, that is, funds, additional funds for printing for state agencies, that the printing demand will increase. Therefore, rather than eliminate additional positions beyond those which the governor and the agency have recommended be reduced, that are either vacant at the current time or the agency is unable to fill for some reason or another, and refill them when demand increases, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that reductions in services and supplies of $10,000 be made. Now, this $10,000 would come from the travel budget for the agency.
Where would we find this?
Let's see. Look under.
Just under printing, but that's
good. Well, yeah, they haven't got it broken down that way, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to have to make a new schedule
we
for
don't
you.
We see where you're.
Okay.
I don't know when you're taking it.
And then because that department will have to have your comments too, as well as saying that you make them available to them so they can.
Now, these I've already discussed with the agency, Mr. Chairman. There's a 98.8% increase. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, a 144% increase in the agency's travel budget. The agency travel budget is increased from $15,430 estimated for the 7981 biennium to combined totals of $37,678. The amount you show here, Joan, is I think in error. The combined package and the RLB totals the $37,678. And that's a 144% increase beyond the current biennium. Now, while some of this increase is represented by the impact of the new courier service associated with the reorganization of the copier centers, nearly 40% of the increase is included in the reduced level budget. Removal of the $10,000 will still permit the agency a 75% increase over the existing biennium travel. And this should be sufficient for even the busiest courier to shuttle back and forth from agencies to the new reorganized centralized copy centers. The Legislative Fiscal Office also recommends that $97,100 be deleted from the capital outlay. And you'll find this in, I believe it's package 235. Under the printing plant budget. And that's on page 26. Now this $97,100 was projected to be used to purchase a new 9400 Xeroxing machine. But I want you to understand that all the existing equipment that now rests in these individual copy centers will be brought together into the new centralized copy centers. There then would be five copy centers. And those centers will be located, one would be here in the Capitol building, one would be over in the employment building, third one would be up in Portland, and those three will remain intact. And the two new copy centers, one would be an additional one here on the mall. I'm not sure you decided yet, Darryl, where that's going to be located. Is that going to be a public service building?
Highway building.
Highway? And the fifth one would be a centralized plant out at the printing plant. So any additional workload that these centralized copying centers would not be able to handle would be able to be backed up by the printing plant itself. So I don't believe that at this point in time that that new machine is necessary. If, however, the workload demands the new machine, and Darryl can find that kind of money in his budget to purchase the new machine, he ought to be permitted that sort of flexibility within the existing budget.
If I could ask a question.
Okay.
We have a coffee center now that's managed by your division or by your department in the basement next to the mail room, right? Mm-hmm.